word. It's going. Okay, so I want to get back into the story of Yaakov. We're actually going to skip a bunch of parts of his story in Laban's house, and we'll get back to them at a later point. I want to skip over his time in Laban's house, the birth of the first 11 Shvatim. We're going to skip right now. And I want to move on to his departure from Laban's house, because it's a very interesting story that people don't focus on all that much. But a lot of things happen as he leaves. He really flees from Laban's house because he doesn't want to be stopped by his cheating father-in-law. But as he leaves the house, there's a lot of events to talk about. So I want to focus on Yaakov's departure from Laban's house. And namely today, the main thing is Rachel's theft of Laban's trufim, his idols. I want to talk more about what Rachel was doing, what these idols were, why she stole them. I want to get into that. But first, I guess let's bring us up to context in terms of the story. So we learned the past few weeks, so Yaakov had to work to marry his wives, Rachel and Leah. We know he worked for 14 years, seven for Rachel. He wanted Rachel, he married Leah, seven more to actually marry Rachel. He then worked six more years to make money. So he was there for 20 years. During that time, he had 11 kids, and 11 boys and one girl, Dina. The rabbis say he actually had more kids than that, but the ones the Torah focuses on are these 12, the first 11 Shvatim, and then Dina, his daughter. At a certain point, Yaakov determines it's time to return to Eretz Yisrael to see his parents. And after 20 years of work, he's ready to go home. Go back, leave Laban's house, and go back and build up his own life. That was his goal. He felt also at this point that Laban was kind of done with him. I mean, Laban had enough. Now, Yaakov, as much as Laban tried to cheat Yaakov always came out on top. Yaakov was honest. He did everything as he was supposed to. But Hashem assisted Yaakov in being successful. And as many tricks as Laban tried to play on Yaakov, Yaakov always did fine. And he walked away as a wealthy man from this whole deal. Yaakov received nevuah, prophecy that he should leave. And additionally, his wives felt that their father had sold them out. Now, they were still upset from the marriage incident. Rachel and Leah said, he's selling us for work in his farm. I mean, we're not pieces, we're not cows. We're not pieces of property. We're women. So they felt rejected by their father. Yaakov felt that Laban was done having him around. Yaakov gave up on Laban, and he received prophecy, it's time to go back home. So it was time to go. And everybody agreed, both Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, and Hashem, it was the right time to return back to Eretz Yisrael and to be with his parents. And again, the wives were resentful. They're resentful of their father, the way that their father treated them. And I assume also the way their father treated Yaakov. So they took all the money that was rightfully theirs and they left. They left secretly. They didn't tell Laban they were leaving, which we'll discuss later on how they impacted Laban. But they sort of just snuck out without Laban knowing and started going back there to Yisrael. And I want to pick up the story on it's Perek Lamed Aleph, chapter 31, verse 19, page 163 in your Stone Chumash, if you have that in front of you. And it tells us a very interesting thing, which I want to sort of delve into today. It says, Laban had gone to shear his sheep. So as they were trying to escape, I see a question here. Who were the mothers of these other unnamed children? Why were they not Shvatim? Good question. So Yisrael asked me a question. He said, who are the mothers of the other possible children of Yaakov? And why are they not Shvatim? So the answer is, the rabbis say that every single one of the children had a twin, of boys had a twin girl born along with him. So they're not Shvatim because they were women. The women were not the fathers of Shvatim. And the mothers were the same mothers as their twin brother. So that'd be the answer there. So in verse 19, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the trufim that belonged to her father. So it says clearly that Rachel stole trufim. Now, what are trufim? So trufim are some form or accessory of idolatry. What is it? We'll discuss more in depth in a moment. But just compare it to verse 20. In verse 20, it says, Yaakov deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him he was fleeing. So you lose a lot in the English translation here. Because if you look in the Hebrew, in Pasuk Yates and Pasuk Chaf, you see an interesting contrast of language. When it says Rachel stole the idols, it says a tignov Rachel asa trufim. Tignov, geneva, which means theft. And then it says in verse 20, Vayignov Yaakov slave Laban Arami. So they both stole something. Rachel stole the idols, and Yaakov literally stole Laban's heart, which we translate as deception. If you look in the English, it says Jacob deceived Laban. But there's a contrast here of Rachel stealing and Yaakov stealing. Rachel stole idols, Yaakov stole his heart, meaning he deceived him. But commentaries say that this is actually looked at as it was positive in the sense that we're saying that's all they stole. Meaning every single other penny they took with them was 100% honest. Now, if you live in someone's house for 20 years, or you work in a workplace for 20 years, odds are at some point you pocketed a pencil by accident, you took a paperclip, maybe you took a drink of water that you weren't supposed to take, maybe you took like a bag of chips that wasn't here. I mean, things happen. But when it says that Yaakov stole Laban's heart and Rachel stole the idols, this is to the exclusion of any other theft. There was nothing else in their possession that was stolen, which again, we'll talk about more later on. But you do have this interesting contrast of language of Yaakov stealing, quote unquote, and Rachel stealing idols and Yaakov stealing the heart of Laban, meaning deceiving him. Now, what are these idols? What are these trufim, as it says in the, that's the word trufim. And why did she steal them? Why was she allowed to steal them? I mean, there's a lot of questions to ask about this story. So I want to sort of delve into this topic. I think it's not discussed often, but there's something we can learn from it. So the first question is, what are trufim? I mean, there's a lot of different idols the Torah mentions and discusses. What exactly are trufim? So there's a difference in commentaries explaining what trufim are. So I just want to go through a few possibilities. The Eben Ezra cites two possible understandings of trufim. The first thing he says is that it's a copper piece that helps to tell the time. So I'm assuming it's some form of a sundial, is my guess what that means. But people who are aware of astrology, astrologists, who know the Chochmas HaMazalos, who know the wisdom of astrology, so they actually would put on this timepiece or this sundial images of constellations. And through that, somehow, this sundial would start speaking. The images would start speaking and telling you about the future. So it was some form of, witchcraft or idolatry that had to do with a timepiece and constellations drawn on the timepiece, and this would speak. And the fact that it spoke as a pasuk in the book of Zechariah, it says a trufim dibru oven. It says trufim speak, corruption, speak sinfully, but it says they speak. So there's some idea of these trufim being able to actually speak. So that's one approach to trufim. The Eben Ezra himself, so that's one, he cites that one idea. Then he says, well, it could be, it seems even more likely that these were actually idols resembling people. So it wasn't a sundial, but it was idols resembling people. And the source for this is actually a story about David HaMelech, about King David. But what was the source? Because there was a point where David HaMelech was locked up in his house, kind of like, it was kind of like being in jail, being jailed at home. And he was there with his wife, Michal. And there were guards stationed around the house, and David wanted to sneak out. So it says Michal put trufim in the bed. So it appeared like David was sleeping in the bed. He snuck out of the house. So if the trufim was like a sundial, it wouldn't do very good to replace David in bed. If you put a sundial in your bed, it doesn't look like a human being. If trufim are idols that resemble people, so it's like a mannequin. It's actually stuck a mannequin into David's bed and he was able to escape. Now, why they had these idols in the house is a different discussion, not for right now, meaning David and Melch, he would assume, would have no idols in his house. But to say it was a sundial, but yet it would resemble David in bed doesn't make much sense. So it makes sense. It looked like a human being. And it was some form of it looked like a mannequin in some ways, but looked like a human being. And that was some idol that was in the image of a human. So that's a second approach to the trufim work. Now there's a third approach, part of the description here, it's a little bit gruesome, but it's a medrash, it needs to be said. So the medrash actually says that the way they make trufim is the following way. They would take a firstborn son and slaughter him. We know the idol worshippers used to be involved in human sacrifice, which is part of the challenge of Abraham, who fought against it and then was told to go sacrifice his son. But they were involved in human sacrifice. They slaughtered a firstborn son. They would then chop the body up and preserve it with salt and other types of spices and things that preserve the body. They would then write some form of magical name, Ruach HaTumah, an impure name, spiritual but impure name on a golden plate. They put it under the tongue of this slaughtered firstborn. They'd hang it on the wall. They would light candles around it. They would bow to it and worship it, and it would start speaking. So that's the way the Medrash describes Truffin. So again, it's a kind of, a gruesome description, but in the world of pagans, idolatry, these weren't uncommon things which occurred historically. And this is something, this ruach, this shame, this name of the ruach atumah, this impure spirit, would allow it to speak. Now, I think it's important maybe just to toss in a point in our discussion for today. Now, we understand that the idolatry is obviously false. Idolatry is, stands up and opposed to everything we believe in. But there is a reality the Torah prescribes to the world of, impure spirits, meaning that they're not separate from Hashem. Hashem controls that world as well. But there are ways to be involved in the quote unquote magic or spirituality in ways that are forbidden and impure. And the world of idolatry utilizes these things. Nowadays, it's not really, recognized or used. I mean, some might say in the Far East, there's still some sort of magic things happening sometimes, or off in the jungles of South America, things like that. I've never been there, I can't prove it. But overall, the Torah does recognize that there was historically a power called Ruach HaTumah, the impure spirits. It was under, they're not separate from Hashem. Hashem put those in the world as well. They put it here to be challenges to us. But there was a reality to idolatry. That's why idolatry had such an attraction, because it seemed to be alive and real. That seemed to be part of the draw of idolatry. There was something you really felt you would gain from it. You would see it as a reality and you would sense it as a reality. So this third approach to what Truffin are is this, again, this tongue put on the wall of a slaughtered child, a slaughtered firstborn, that they would bow to and light candles around, and then it would start speaking. So there's three different approaches as to what Truffin were. In Levin and Truffin, it seems Truffin were a normal type of idolatry in those days. So why did Rachel steal these Truffin? Why'd she steal them? So Rashi says simply, she wanted to separate her father from his idolatry. Now, I guess she had hoped all these years living around Yaakov, maybe he would do tshuva and recognize Hashem, drop the idols. I guess it never really worked. And Rachel said, this is my last chance. I'm leaving the house. Let me steal the idols. Now, stealing the idols, what good would that do? I mean, he'll go find some more idols. I mean, he's still an idolater. He still believes in idolatry. So why did she think stealing the idols would be beneficial? So some commentaries say that Rachel felt that Levin would be smart enough to say the following to himself. If my gods can be stolen, they must not be gods. Because how do you steal God? So it would diminish the power of these idols in Levin's eyes. And maybe he would come to recognizing Hashem. That was Rachel's hope. If a god can be stolen, then you can probably conclude it's not really a god. In the same way that Avraham Avinu went and smashed his father's idols in the famous story, and he was trying to show if you can smash the idols, then obviously they can't be divine. How could you smash? If this is God, how could he be smashed? So it was the same kind of rationale that Rachel had in stealing them, that she hoped her father would conclude, well, if my gods can be stolen, they must not be very powerful. So that's one reason why she stole them. Another reason that is quoted as to why she stole the Truffin is, as we said before, Truffin could speak. And what would they tell you about? They could tell you about the future. I don't know. They could tell you about happenings around the world. I'm not sure what they would tell you exactly. But, we said that Rachel and Leah and Yaakov's whole family, they were sneaking away. They were fleeing from Lavan under the cover of darkness. They didn't want to be caught. And Rachel was concerned. Well, Lavan might go consult with his idols, and they'll tell him what happens. So I have to steal these idols so Levin doesn't have, it was like his spy. He would have top secret information revealed to Levin that Yaakov had snuck away and where they were, etc. It would divulge the secret. So because of that, she stole the idols. Another reason why she stole the idols was because of that reason. She didn't want the idols to tell Levin what happened. So the other question is, so why did she steal them, not destroy them? I mean, really, we have a mitzvah to destroy idols. And Rachel did not destroy them. She stole them. She held on to them. When Levin actually pursued them later on, Levin's looking for the idols and Rachel's still hiding them at the time. Later on, she seems to have disposed of them. But why wouldn't she just destroy the idols? Why did she just steal them and keep them with her? So that's a hard question to answer. I don't have many answers to that. I did see one commentary approach to that question, the Maharal. The Maharal says that she didn't want to destroy the idols because she was concerned for the following. She was concerned that Levin would pursue them. And she would say that, the idols were destroyed, I don't have many more. And Levin would say, no, you have them. And he would hold them back until she actually produced them. I mean, her main goal now was that she should get back to Eretz Yisrael and not be held up in Lavan's house. So if Lavan came to pursue them and she had no choice, then she might actually offer him the idols back again so he would lay off their back and they can go. But if they're destroyed, she couldn't convince him they're destroyed, and he might hold up their trip or do who knows what he would do until he found them, but he wouldn't find them, but it would delay their trip. So that was one possible explanation as to why she did not destroy them, she only stole them. But I think there'd probably be more said about that, because you would think she has to destroy them because it's a mitzvah to destroy idolatry. So I'm not sure, I don't know what other reasons she had for not destroying those idols. Okay, so that answers two of our questions. What were these idols, and why did she steal them? So now let's move on to the next question, which is why is she allowed to steal them? This is actually a very important halachic question. And let's maybe phrase the question in another way. If you have a friend or family member that has something in their possession which is forbidden or dangerous, are you allowed to steal it or not, or destroy it? On the one hand, the person is likely to use this thing either to violate the Torah or to harm or damage themselves or somebody else. On the other hand, it's their possession, and the Torah says you can't steal and you can't damage other possessions. So what takes precedence? So the example here, let's say this is a far-off example for us. Now your friend has an idol in the house, right? They own that idol. The idol belongs to them. Having an idol in the house is forbidden. Worshipping an idol is certainly forbidden. Do you have permission to luckily go steal or destroy that idol? Or do you say, no, that's their possession. I should go and speak to them about how bad idolatry is. Again, this is a funny example for us in modern times, but it illustrates the point. Or can I just destroy it and steal it because it's forbidden? The same question is actually discussed. Let's say something dangerous. Somebody has drugs for them in their house, dangerous drugs. Somebody has something in their house that could harm another. So are you allowed to go and destroy or steal that harmful substance? Or do you have to say, no, that's theft, and theft is usur, it's forbidden. What do you do? So the question here as well, Rachel stole these idols. Did she have a right to steal them? Was she allowed to steal them? Seemingly, if Rachel did it, it was okay to do. Rachel Imenu, we look at her actions, a great tzaddikus, a very righteous woman. So, but we have to figure out why was that okay. So this question is discussed at length by many commentaries. I want to maybe go through some of the points about this question. So number one, let's actually go back for a moment to the reason why she stole them. We had two possible reasons. One reason was just to separate her father from idolatry. The other reason was to protect her family. The loved ones shouldn't find out from the idols where they were, because the idols could actually spill the beans that they fled. So according to that second explanation, that she was concerned the idol would tell loved one that they had fled, it could be she's allowed to steal them because that was a question of life and death. If loved one found out that they fled, it could be loved one killed them. And that, like the Haggadah tells us, loved one actually desired to kill out Yaakov and his family. He didn't succeed. He desired that. Hashem stopped him. But we know that bikuach nefesh, saving a life, pushes aside most mitzvos, not everything, most mitzvos. And it seems that, again, according to many, there it'd be permissible to steal something to save a life. So if Rachel felt that leaving these idols behind would endanger my life, Yaakov's life, our children's lives, so she'd be allowed to steal in order to save her life. So that's one way to look at it. And in general, we can say that if stealing something will save a life, you could steal it. That's actually a larger discussion, which is not for right now, but that's not actually so simple. But let's just take that understanding for the moment, that stealing to save a life would be allowed. But let's say the reason she stole them was another reason. The other reason that she stole them, Rashi says, was to separate her father from idolatry. She's trying to stop him from violating the Torah. We know that idols are even forbidden for Ben Noach, for a non-Jew. It's one of the seven Noahide laws, the Mrs. Ben Noach. So why was she, if her total intent was not to save her life, it was just to help her father out, that he shouldn't do idolatry, why was it permissible to steal the idols? That's a big question. So let's understand, was it okay or not? I mean, did the rabbis see this as something Rachel did wrong, or is it okay? So we actually find later on in the parsha, which probably we'll speak about next time, the Lavan comes to Yaakov and accuses him. You ran away in the middle of the night. You didn't give me a chance to kiss my children and grandchildren, and you stole my God. How dare you? So Yaakov says, Yaakov says, we didn't steal anything. He didn't know Rachel stole it. He said, whoever stole the idol should die. because Yaakov was someone who was honesty was his policy, as they say. Yaakov is the Ish Emes, the man of truth. And for Yaakov, theft would be crossing a big red line. So Yaakov, without realizing that Rachel stole it, said, with whoever you find your idol, that person should die. So Yaakov didn't realize it was Rachel. Now Yaakov was mistaken in what he said, but the rabbis say that this is one reason that Rachel died prematurely. Now Rachel died young. She died at Binyamin's birth. And she was buried before they really got back to Eretz Yisrael. She was buried on the road. And the rabbis say that really Yaakov never meant for Rachel to die. Had he known, he wouldn't have said this. But since the words of a tzaddik are so powerful, there's consequences. So based on that, it seems that on the one hand, there was something negative about stealing it, because if Yaakov's curse would actually apply to her, that means there's something she did wrong. On the other hand, the rabbis say a very fascinating point. The rabbis say that the words of a tzaddik, even if they're said conditionally or by mistake, have consequences. And I want to talk more about that maybe later on. But it could be that what Rachel did wasn't bad. But being that Yaakov said these words are so powerful because it came out of Yaakov's pure mouth that they have consequences regardless. So you can look at it two ways. Maybe this is a punishment for her for stealing. Or maybe no, what she did was okay, but it's just the power of a tzaddik's word is so powerful, those words are going to have an impact and make a difference. So I will get more to that. But the Zohar says a fascinating thing. The Zohar says, why did Rachel die early? Why did this curse cause her to die? So Zohar says that because she caused her father distress, meaning stealing was actually okay. She was permitted to steal the idols. What she's blamed for is not the theft. She's blamed for causing her father distress. Lavan was pained. He was distressed because his idols were stolen. So according to the Zohar, there was no issue with the theft. The issue was the impact it had upon her father. So it sounds like the theft was okay. So let's figure out, why would this theft be okay? So I'll give you a few different approaches. So one approach is the following. This one is based on a discussion in Halacha. And that discussion is, if idolatry is forbidden to use, meaning the Torah forbids not just worshiping idols, but possessing an idol, having any benefit from an idol at all. You can't even own an idol. You can't sell an idol. You can't do anything. You can't use it. You can't use the idol and benefit from it in any way, shape, or form. So if something has no benefit to you, it could be it's worthless. I mean, what do I mean by that? If I have something in this room that has zero usage, right? Let's say I have here, I have an item, and there's no way it could be used. No one in the world could use it for anything. So does that have any value to it at all? I can't sell it. There's no value to it. There's no usage. So if I steal that item, have I stolen anything? The answer is no, because it's valueless. So according to this approach, being that idols are forbidden to benefit from, so then the idol is a worthless thing, which means if I steal it, I didn't steal anything. So it'd be okay to steal idols. And based on this, it's okay to steal anything that's forbidden to benefit from because it's worthless. If I have an item that no one in the world can use, it's a worthless item. So that's one approach. But some say this wouldn't work in our scenario. Why not? Because some say that even though a Jew is not allowed to benefit from an idol, a non-Jew can. Meaning a non-Jew can't worship idols, but some say, luckily, a non-Jew would be allowed to benefit from an idol. That's a dispute. That's a machlokas. So if a non-Jew could benefit from an idol, Lavan was a non-Jew. And it could be that Lavan would be allowed to worship it, but Lavan wouldn't be allowed to use it for something else, sell it, use it to hold his coffee on or something. He could use it for something. So if that's the case, it has value and still be theft. So this answer only works if you say that a non-Jew is not allowed to benefit from idols. So that's one answer. And there's another answer given to this. And this is actually based on a story in the Gemara. The story is something which is a little hard for us to understand. But the story, it displays a certain zealousness that the rabbis had in their times. The Gemara says the following story. It says, Rav Ada bar Ava was once walking down the street. And he saw a girl wearing something that was very inappropriate. I don't know exactly what made it inappropriate. It was an inappropriate article of clothing. I mean, something that maybe was very flashy, attracting men, whatever it was. And he got so upset, he tore the clothing off of her. Because he got so upset by it. And how dare a Jewish girl walk down the street and give this challenge to so many men around her? It's inappropriate. So he tore off the clothes from her to make a point. Now, for us, the whole situation would be is a funny situation. You know, nowadays, it would be very, quite controversial if that happened. But it was because of Rav Ada Bar Ava's, you know, great respect and value of Torah and modesty that he couldn't control himself. And he went and he tore off this article of clothing. Now, the Gemara says that turned out she wasn't Jewish. She was a non-Jewish girl. And therefore, he had to pay for the item. Because, you know, if it's a Jewish girl, that's one thing. But she wasn't Jewish. She could wear whatever she wants. You know, it's not up to you to decide what a non-Jewish girl could wear. And therefore, he had to pay money for the article of clothing that he tore. Now, it sounds like, though, had she been Jewish, then he wouldn't have to pay anything. What he did was okay. That's what sounds like the Gemara. He only had to pay because she wasn't Jewish. So the Beis Din said you have to pay her for the shirt you destroyed. The court, the Beis Din, whoever he went to. But if she had been a Jewish girl, it would have been okay for him to tear off that clothing and destroy it. And that would have been okay. So it seems from that Gemara that if somebody is going to be performing a Torah prohibition, you have the right to destroy their property or take it or to stop them. That's what Gemara sounds like. We don't mean like, you know, to bully them. But we mean the actual item causing the problem you could take away or destroy. That's what it sounds like. So the great Rav of Yerushalayim from the early 1900s, Rav Yitzchak Chaim Zonnenfeld, he actually used this as a source for the following question. Let's say you know somebody who has, you know, in their hands or in their house a heretical newspaper. It's a newspaper that has all these articles against Torah, against Hashem, clear, you know, black and white, heresy, apikorsis, kfira, denying Hashem, denying Torah. As if for a Jew reading that would be forbidden. You can't read articles of heresy, apikorsis, you can't do that. So Rav Yisrael Chaim Zonnenfeld says that you'd be allowed to destroy that newspaper. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to somebody else. Being that paper is the cause of avera, of sin, of doing something which is wrong, you have permission to go ahead and destroy the newspaper. That's what he says. Because and the idea is the following. The idea, we have a mitzvah called Lifnei Iver Lo Satin Mechshel. We discussed this when we did mitzvahs a couple years ago. You're not supposed to put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. Which the rabbis say, don't just take that literally. You know, you shouldn't trip a blind man. That's clear. But it also means, in the figurative sense, that you can't give people bad advice. And you can't cause people to sin. So there's three parts to it. There's possibly the physical tripping of a blind man is one thing. There is giving bad advice is one thing. That's also called lifnei iver, that you've caused someone to stumble in the theoretical sense. And then there is helping someone to do an avera, helping someone to sin. And the Rambam says that one of the functions of lifnei iver, he says, roi lekalka lehem, you can be destructive to them. And if someone's about to do a sin, it sounds like you can actually destroy, what according to the Rambam, destroy the property they're using to stop them. You know, you have a Jew about to take a bite of the pork chop. They own the pork chop. They pay for it with their own money. They made an acquisition on it. You could take it and you could toss it to the dogs. And you could do that. Why? Because it's an item that they're about to sin with, and you have the right. There's no prohibition of theft or damaging if you take that item and destroy it or steal it. So this is another approach to the issue. This is also said by the Avni Nezer, the Sakachover Rebbe, who's looked at as someone who's a great halakhic authority. And he writes that you're allowed to steal items from somebody to stop them from prohibitions. And he says the source for this is Rachel stealing the truffin, Rachel stealing the idols. So this approach would be that you're allowed to steal something or destroy something if it's going to prevent someone else from doing an avera, from doing a sin. That'd be this approach. So the first approach was it was allowed because it was worthless, because it was forbidden to benefit from it. It was a worthless item. But the second approach is that really this can be expanded beyond worthless items. Anytime someone else is about to do a prohibition, you're allowed to take the item and destroy it or steal it, and that'd be okay to do. So let's maybe even apply this. You know, Postkin discussed the question that we answered before. Let's say it's not a Torah prohibition. It's not a religious thing, but it's something which is dangerous. Somebody possesses, you know, dangerous drugs. Somebody possesses explosives. You know, somebody has a gun that shouldn't have that gun and is threatening others with that gun. Somebody has an addiction. and you know they're supposed to have no alcohol around, and they brought alcohol to their house. You know, it could destroy their life. You could even kill them. So based on this approach, there's good grounds to say you're in the full right to destroy or steal that item to prevent somebody from damaging themselves or others. So you have to be very careful with this, obviously, because you have to really determine, right now you're about to steal something that belongs to somebody else. They're gonna be quite upset if they find out. You're saying, yeah, but this is something that could cause you to do sin or to hurt yourself or hurt others. So you should certainly think very long and hard before you actually go ahead and do this. That's for sure. And be very careful. It's a judgment call. It could cause a lot of trouble. Somebody legally purchases a gun and they have it in their house and they say it's for self-defense and they have they say all the right things about the gun. But you know this person is a person that you think is very dangerous to have the gun. So is it right or wrong? You know, they're not going to give up the gun themselves. So if you wanted to go steal that gun, can you? It's a very good question. I can't answer the question. It's a case by case thing. But you know, like we said, you know, the alcoholic has alcohol in the house. So can you go steal that alcohol? I don't know. I mean, it's really a case by case question. How dangerous will it be for this person, or how not dangerous will it be? But it's a fascinating discussion, and a lot of it's based on this story. Rachel stole the idols, and what Rachel did was okay to do. So these are different approaches to the issue, but again, it has a lot of modern day ramifications. I want to add one more point. So we mentioned before, so Laban comes and accuses Yaakov. You know, why'd you steal my idols? Yaakov does not know that Rachel stole them. And Laban wants to come and kill Yaakov for it. He says, Hashem told me not to do anything to you. So we'll talk about that another time. So Laban refrains from hurting Yaakov. Rachel succeeds in hiding the Trafim, and Laban never discovers them. Eventually she disposes of them. But Rachel dies an early death because of this incident. And the rabbis tell us it was based on Yaakov's words. Yaakov said, whoever has the idols shall die, not knowing that Rachel has the idols. So there's a fascinating point here I mentioned before, which is the words of a tzaddik, they are powerful, whether he means what he said or not, whether they are conditional and the conditions were not met. If a tzaddik says words, they have an effect. That's why I want to bring out a point for a moment from the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Maseches Ksuvos that basically tells a story of one of the great sages. And not to get into the details of the story, but it basically says he said something. I think his son-in-law did not return for a while from somewhere he was supposed to come back, and he came back late. And before he came back, the father-in-law said it could be that he died because he didn't come back. It's one of those lines, not getting to the details. And even though he hadn't died at the moment, he was actually just learning in the Beis Medrash. At that moment, it says, I think the ceiling collapsed upon him and killed him. And the Gemara says a quote, it says, it's kishvaga yotze b'fnei ha-shaul. It's like if a king puts out a decree, which is bad. Ultimately, that decree is going to take effect, whether it's good or bad. Like Achashverosh, I put it out there and I can't take it back. So it says when a tzaddik says words, like this person has died, even if the person's still alive, those words might have impact, the person might die. Now, he didn't mean that. And had he known that the person was alive and well, he would have never said such a thing. He didn't want his son-in-law to be killed in this way. But the Gemara says, nach nafshi, the person died. Now, how do we explain that? This is a very fascinating explanation from Chanan Wasserman. Chanan Wasserman, you know, one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Baranovich, one of the greatest students of the Chofetz Chaim. He writes in his Sefer Kovet Shurim, he says that when a tzaddik speaks with his pure mouth, untainted by saying any sort of Lashon Hara or anything bad in his life, so he says the words are like a sharpened axe. That if you swing an axe, whether or not you intend to hurt somebody, if someone's in the way, it's going to hurt them. It's reality. He says that dibura adam, the words of a human being, if your lips are pure, words are like sharp, it's like axes. It's like a sword, and the words take effect regardless of whether you mean them or not. Most of us, though, because we use our mouths for so many things, we should use them for. So then the mouth, it's like you have rust, you know, rust, which is growing on your sword, so it won't cut anymore. If your sword gets rusty, if your axe gets rusty, then it won't chop anymore. So most of our mouths are rusty. And we speak, our words don't have so much power because, you know, we've caused, through the way we speak, wasting words, lashon hara, inappropriate things. We've caused those words, our mouths, to become rusty, and therefore the words don't take effect. But a great tzaddik who's careful with their words, those words have implications no matter what. It's like swinging that sharp axe, hit something, it's going to chop it. That's what Rav Chanan says. So Yaakov said, whoever has the idol should die. Yaakov didn't really mean it, and he never knew Rachel had them. He never dreamed Rachel would have them. But because those words were said, Rachel died early. And you hear all these stories sometimes of these, you know, this rabbi said this, and it happened afterwards, you know. So we don't have to say it's magic, but it could speak very much the power of words. We don't understand how powerful words actually are. Words are realities. The word in Hebrew for word is dibur, which means a davar, an object. It's a thing. It's concrete. Words are concrete. They're real. They're objects. Because we speak with our mouths in ways which are not appropriate sometimes, we cause them to get rusty, and therefore the words aren't so sharp. The words don't have those implications. But when a tzaddik speaks, these words have major implications. So I think it's a big lesson for us, the power of words and what words can mean, and how powerful our mouths can be if we're careful with what we speak about. That's an important lesson. And the bigger picture here also is, you know, Rachel intended to help out her father. She wanted to stop him from idolatry. That didn't seem to work. But we do learn an important halachic lesson from here as to when is it okay to steal or destroy something which caused someone else to do prohibitions or something else dangerous. And this is a big source for that discussion. Okay, any questions? All right, great.
So thank you, Rabbi. I have to leave. It was very good.
All right, thank you again. Thank you very much. Look forward to it.
Very good. Very profound.
Thank you.